was right there in the audience. Catherine's been working on this project for the last 6 months and came to us through a recommendation from Jaime. So it's a nice kind of parallel that we're both up here and presenting our work, and we have a student from links us both. So without any further ado, what I'm going to do is just have Jaime come and do his presentation, and hopefully we'll have time for some questions at the end of this.
Thank you, Dido, for inviting me. Today I'm going to apologize in advance because what I'm going to present is loaded with a disturbing amount of visual violence. The type of visual violence that might result offensive to those of you who have forgotten that the new organism is more, much more, than just a market-driven exercise with pragmatic overtones. As difficult as it may be, I will try to stay away from discussions about politics, sociology, and economics. In the true spirit of the new organism, I will concentrate on issues of urban form, building type, and public space, for it is there where I think that our immediate responsibility lies and where our most durable effects may be carried out. I believe that what I'm about to present will be one of the most important democratic design crusades of the next 20 years, a challenge which is currently affecting more than 75% of our global population. I am sure that by the middle of my presentation, you might start feeling a little bit of discomfort, because I shall insist and demonstrate with images and drawings that informal urbanism is worthy of the Congress for the New Urbanism research time. By informal urbanism, I don't mean random and chaotic urbanism. In many other ways, I will also claim that the design principles of informal urbanism may be carried here in America. So the presentation will be divided in three sections. In the first section, I will introduce theory concepts and definitions in an attempt to ground the problem. In the second, I will try to describe what the urban morphology and building types are in the composition of informal urbanism. And finally, I will demonstrate the applicability of these concepts and forms in the context of an existing project in Indonesia. So let's start here. This is the traditional American family, which is, in my opinion, dying of a disease that is called affluenza. They have everything that they need for their daily living within their house, not at walking distance, within their house. This is a photograph taken for a book called Material Culture by Peter Menzel, and he asked families around the world to display the things that they thought were most precious in their houses, in order of ascendance. Things in their hands will be the most important things, and the things in the background will be the things that they care the least. As you can see, the lady in the picture is carrying the Bible, he's carrying his hat. Obviously, he's from here, from Texas. But what is important about this image is that this image represents 21.6% of the American population. That's approximately 16.4 million households. And it's not the entire picture, of course. I mean, if it's only 21.6% of the population, then the picture is incomplete. This traditional family likes to live in T2, T3, or T4. And they respond perfectly well to the Pareto Optimal. They're located in the city, I mean, in areas where transportation is really difficult and almost inexistent. That's why, I mean, as you saw in the picture, they had, I mean, two wonderful cars parked in the double space garage in the front of the house. Now, non-traditional families, the ones that don't respond to a Pareto Optimal, represent 237.5 million people in America. I mean, most of the of this population are non-transsexual, non-transsexual. I listen to this really well. Yeah, there are a lot of gays here too. Single mothers, single fathers, extended families like the one in the picture that include their grandparents as part of the family. And they like to live in areas that are interstitial. I mean, maybe T6, T5, T4, or they invent their own T-zone. Worldwide, this type of family is 92.4% of the population. That's approximately 6 billion people. And these are data that I have collected from the United Nations Habitat report of 2007. Now, when I say that they invent their own transect, I don't mean that they don't correspond to the transect as proposed by the CNU. It's just that they live in a reverse transect. And for obvious reasons. I mean, like, let's say in Latin America, the Latin American city, the typical city of the Law of Indies, was a foundational city. So the founders wanted to have the best plots of land in the center of the city. The larger lots are in the center, the smaller lots are in the periphery. Larger lots in the center, very small lots in the periphery. So subconsciously we carried this through years and years of urban traditions. And we know that when the rural population is coming to the city, they're not going to go in the center of the city. They're going to go to the outskirts of the city. And that's roughly what happens in 75% of the built world in this universe. So the transect for these families and for this type of people looks more or less like this. I mean, the one on the top is, let's say, the transect of the Latin American city today, and the one in the bottom is, let's say, the transect of the Islamic city nowadays. All of these corresponding to what I would like to introduce as informal urbanism. So 43% of the urban territory in developed countries is done with informal urbanism, and 78% in underdeveloped countries. The rate of growth of these areas is 1 million people per week between last year and the year 2030. If we are going to talk about density and crowding, I mean, in these areas, which are by our standards very crowded, there are approximately 150 people per acre, and the density is between 80 and 300 units to the acre. And let's very quickly make a differentiation between density, which is amount of units, and crowding, which is amount of people. People per acres and units per acre. To give you an idea of a comparison, in this formally planned world in which we live, in Paris, there are 84 people per acre and 42 units per acre. In New York, only 47 people per acre and 21 units to the acre. In most American cities, there are only 10 to 12 people per acre and 3 to 6 units to the acre. So, I mean, and you wonder why we have a sustainability problem. Okay. Now, the interesting thing about informal urbanism is that informal urbanism is an invasion. It's an invasion of the existing city. So it's like kudzu. And I'm sure that if you live in the northeast of America, you know what kudzu is. Kudzu is this vine that crawls all over the landscape and chokes the landscape to death. Let's say that formal urbanism is that little house in the middle of the prairie right there, and that this informal urbanism is crawling all over the place. And so that's the type of urbanism that I'm about to present. If we continue with this type of analogy between natural and informalities and informal urbanism, then we are forced to talk about typologies. And like a good, let's say, person that likes nature, let's pretend that we are 19th century inhabitants, I mean citizens of the 18th century, and that we are classifying Kudzu. I mean, this is a photograph of Kudzu, a photograph of that leaf, and we know that, I mean, for people studying botanics, that will be a truncate type of leaf. If you look at Kudzu, I mean, through a microscope, you will see that Kudzu has two sections. I mean, the edges of the Kudzu will be polygonal and created by nuclear blocks. And the interior of the Kudzu will be created of elongated blocks. In the interior, there's a lot of topography. I mean, if you look at a Kudzu leaf, you will see that in the center, it has topography. So the way nature adapts itself to topography is with elongated blocks. The way that nature adapts itself to flat conditions is through polygonal blocks like this, in this case. Now, informal urbanism always attacks the periphery of the city. Any area that is empty will end up with informal urbanism. So, in fact, I mean, when you look at a town like this in Latin America, for instance, all of these areas are waiting for urban Kudzu. Okay. And when Kudzu comes, it comes from one day to the next. I mean, it's not that they planned it and that it's going to happen in weeks. No. One night, you go to bed and the land was like that, and when you wake up in the morning, it is like this. I mean, they are illegal invasions that work with bottoms-up type of regulations. They have great aspirations to be part of the legal establishment. They're all in the periphery. They're spontaneous. They're not pre-planned. They're crowded and dense. They lack basic infrastructure, and they're poverty-infested with non-durable housing. How does the housing come about? The first stage of invasion is a simple tent. I mean, they all come at night and they have their tents settled, I mean, or set in a matter of hours. 2 days later, you come back and they have used all the materials that they have found on the site or near the site to produce a temporary piece of housing. I mean, in here, you can see even gas tanks used for drinking water. Okay. Following week, you come back, and the house is now a two-story house with a terrace. Most probably, they rented this part of the house to somebody else, and now they're living up there. And little by little, it becomes progressively more permanent until you reach this fourth phase, in which they start using materials that really give them a cultural character. I mean, colors that are precise. I mean, this is a little shanty town in Guatemala. The one up here is a shanty town in Oman, shanty town in Colombia, and a shanty town in Argentina. Okay. The next phase is small skyscrapers. So now that they know that the rents are going to be generating some cash, they start going up and up and up and up until they reach four or five stories based on the type of materials that they're able to get. These two pictures here are pictures of an apartment in Venezuela. As you can see, the apartments don't have any furniture whatsoever. They're 30 square meters, more or less, 250 square meters, that's 300 to 500 square feet. And more than five, I mean, sometimes even five families live in a space like that. In terms of retail, the retail is also very informal. It can be a closet in the front facade like here, with a little step where you can sit down and drink your coffee or have your beer. It has doctors, in the middle of the neighborhood. Sometimes, they go a little bit deeper to 10, 20 feet in depth until they become really formal and may reach 40 feet in depth. Now, in terms of the urban structure, in this case, this is a flat development that has rectilinear blocks. And the block works more or less like this. What you see there as a sort of normal block, American block, is actually a block that has what they call a conventillo, which is like a courtyard that allows you to have even greater densities in the middle of the block, like this, with very small houses in there, and then a passageway that allows you to go from this side of the block to the next side of the block, and that gets densified also with more housing types. If you look at the lots, there are lots that are super deep, lots that have, let's say that are medium, and lots that are very small. So even in that type of block, you will find the poor that is rich, the poor that is middle class, and the poor that is really poor. And so there's a social mix also in the block. When you look at the frontages, if you're not paying attention to the frontages here, in Google they seem to be, straight. But in reality, they vary. And they vary according to their experience of the place. These things just happen because they're working, their way through. In the center here, that eventually will become a little public space where they hang out and discuss the matters of the neighborhood. Little by little, they start also adding trees, and by the time they finish with the trees, they introduce a road here. You can see a parallel park car right there. And those, when they pave it, then it becomes part of the structure of the city. The one in the center stays unpaved, and sometimes they cover them with bamboo mats. Okay, so there is the public space. And that's how it looks, from the sky. Okay. When it's irregular, they also work with irregular blocks. Irregular blocks that adapt to a topography. Blocks that are completely regular like this one, blocks that are square like in here, most probably this section of the plan is a little bit more flat. Then they have rectangular blocks that go in the same direction of the topography, and rectangular blocks that go perpendicular to the topography. Having buildings that are double-sided in here, buildings that are single-sided in there, courtyard buildings here, and all kinds of buildings in there with passageways going from one side of the block to the next. In terms of public space, the public space is also unplanned. So it's the result of decisions that are taken on a daily basis. They can be forks on the road, like here. They can be a tree, in the middle of the street, that becomes, a public space. But they're always connected. No matter what, you can go from one public space to the next through what we should call a connector road. And one of those connector roads, this is in Chile, you can see right here. So they have cars, and pedestrians, all at the same time. In terms of the street, as I said, the streets, the passageways in the middle are very informal. They're rarely paved. They have porches where they hang clothes, I mean, to dry, because they don't have washers and dryers. Sometimes, I mean, they get more formalized, and people start paving, I mean, the frontage of their houses in order to acquire a little bit more of the front space to show that they have a little bit more power over the public space. And finally, I mean, they frankly pave the whole area, not letting any water to percolate in the underground, causing tremendous problems. As you can see in the pavement that they use for the street is different to a pavement that they use to demarcate, let's say, the sidewalk, and there are no curbs. So it has a sense of territoriality. There are also steep steps, I mean, going all the way to the top of the mountains. I mean, and kids have to climb these mountains twice a day, I mean, when they go and come back from school. The infrastructure is all stolen. They typically steal it from one single place, and they put someone to police the place where they stole the electricity in here. Typically, one single owner asks for electricity, and then he sells the electricity to everybody else. Okay. And when they become part of the government institution, I mean, they get to have incredible means of transportation that are super creative. This is in Valparaíso, Chile. Elevators going all the way up to the mountains. Okay. In terms of water is, I mean, none of these houses have water and sewer. I mean, or rarely have water and sewer. So they go to wells, public wells, in what we might call the public spaces. This is one of them in Venezuela. They also have sports facilities, but as you can see in this field here, you can play basketball, football, soccer, I mean, everything, every sport in one single field. In the relationship to green spaces, most of them are either up there in the mountains or near bodies of water. When they're near bodies of water, they use the water for laundry, and they also have fish farms. Typically in this sort of, in Latin America, they're called palafitos. In the palafito villages, there are mainly fishermen living there. When they're in the mountains, then they have the greens in the mountains to grow their own crops, and they sell them back in the city in markets that look more or less like this. So this is, I mean, the areas where they live. They come down to the city and they sell their products to the citizens that actually occupy the government accepted formal city of 12 units to the acre. And I mean, another variation of the same theme, but in this case, I mean, the town is hanging from the mountain, literally, and they have a close relationship to the green. So that's why you don't see a lot of trees right here, because they only walk one block, I mean, and they find a green right there. Okay. And another type of green is the altar, which you find in the middle of the streets, where a little virgin or a little saint, I mean, to pray that day and feel better about yourself. So just to summarize, this is how it happens. First they lay down the blocks, then they come and lay down the lots. As they lay down the lots, they think about how the street is going to be in the future. Then they put their building types, which are all different, and design in accordance with what they perceive will be best. Then they start, when they get enough money, they add encroachments that are designed to terminate vistas or to create informal open spaces like here. And finally, they add the trees and it becomes, I mean, a formal part of the city. It is at this time that they ask for an address and for nomenclature from the local governments. Okay, so now that you know, I mean, you can identify blocks, plazas, I mean, like this will be the public spaces. You can tell here that probably this one here or this one here is a public building, who knows. And just to give you, one more layer of information so that you can see how it really works. This is a little town in Indonesia, in a town that is called Yogyakarta. The town is called Sidomulyo, and it works like this. I mean, it's more dense on this side. It has building types that are very small, and you can tell very quickly where the public spaces are. Let me see. The materials are all materials that are impermanent, except the first floor of the buildings. The first floor of the buildings tends to be permanent. From that point on, everything is impermanent and made out of bamboo, wood, whatever they can find, metal. As I said, the public spaces are very well defined, I mean, but they're not regular. No, they're all in, and plus, this little town is Islamic, so as you know, in Islamic towns, the regular spaces are the realm of God, Allah. Okay. And finally, I mean, in terms of land uses, the red really means household. That doesn't mean house. I mean, in their house, they have a room or two that are also dedicated to commerce. I mean, either arts and crafts, or they actually sell stuff to the other neighbors. By the way, this section here is the government responds to house some people here. So you can see, it's typical of an American plan of the 1960s, in Philadelphia or in Washington or anywhere else. So what should be the role of the new urbanism before I finish? I think that we should be establishing partnerships with the United Nations Habitat or Housing for Humanity. We should be promoting research on urban morphology and cultural housing types. We should be developing standards for the creation of design alternatives for informal urbanism. And we should be proposing light impact and self-provided infrastructure solutions. Plus, I think that at some point or another, I mean, we need to be involved in demonstration projects for the retrofitting of projects like the ones I just showed so that they can understand what the principles of the new urbanism are all about. That's it. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Jaime. I think Jaime's identified some really great problems that currently exist all over the world, and kind of is a good lead into what I'm going to be talking about, which is one of our projects in India. Jewish rights to respond to some of these issues, and yes or no? Is that good? Is that good? Okay. Sorry about that. So let's look at some of the numbers when it comes to India and what's going on. The current population is over 1 billion people. In urban India, there's over 300 million people. That's all of America living in urban areas, the same population of this country in urban areas, and that too mostly less than 10 major cities. And the immediate need for that, about one-third of the population lives in substandard, not even as good as the housing that Jaime showed. It is informal urbanism, but there is an immediate need to house close to 100 million people, and that translates to about 25 million units. So that's the kind of immediate problem that we have. Also, I'm more familiar with Bombay City, which is where I grew up, and
every day in Bombay, 600 people migrate to the city. And yesterday, Secretary Cisneros talked about New York City going from 9 million to 10 million, or planning for 10 million, and I thought, boy, that's just so easy, those numbers. We're talking about, when I left Bombay in 1972, it was 4 million people, and today it's close to 20 million people. So, you know, in 30 years, it's gone up almost 4 or 5 times. And so this is the dilemma, and I have this dilemma about high-rise buildings, and some of you might know about some of the things that I've been working on and trying to kind of reduce the scale of buildings. But it's really a sheer problem of numbers. How do you actually start to house people in a kind of rational way that makes sense? And I'm working on a book with Leon Krier, and Leon gave me this drawing, knowing about my dilemma, about how every one of those high-rise buildings really wants a small house, but you know, there's just not enough land and space for those for everyone to have a little cottage or a little house, and in the end, you have to go higher, and that's the dilemma we're in. So I'm going to try to break this down into a series of points. In some cities in India, there's been a reemergence of a 15,000-year tradition called Vastu. It's I would say it's the kind of equivalent to Feng Shui for the Chinese, if you're familiar with Feng Shui. It's the Indian version, and it's a doctrine that was written in text about 3,000 years ago. And there's a very strong reemergence of this. And it has to do with the orientation of how various rooms are placed in a house or in a space. And about half of it makes very rational sense to me. The other half doesn't make sense. But in some jurisdictions, there's a very strong belief in Vastu, and you really cannot sell a unit of any kind unless you adhere to the principles. So, you know, things like the master bedroom has to be at the southwest corner. And Catherine over here, who's helped us with this, has now become a Vastu expert, knows exactly, can look at a plan and say it complies or it doesn't comply. But nonetheless, we have been trying to modify all the plans to work with this system. So there's the tradition. There's the other issue of climate. None of the buildings that we actually design are air-conditioned or heated. And so that's just a kind of a normal, you know, any building in India today, there are more LEED-certifiable buildings in India than anywhere else in the world, okay, because the standards are just so low. We constantly, when we do audits on our projects with LEEDs, we automatically qualify for silver anytime, any project, and that just kind of shows you where those standards are without even trying, you know, to try to get the credits. So climate is an issue, and this is a system that we developed about 15 years ago when I was working in India to build a double wall around every structure. It's a redundant structure. What you see in the blue is actually a skin wall, a party wall that's built 1 meter out from the existing structure, and what it does is has a cavity that is vented at the top and allows kind of induction of air through. And if you take the caps up there and you make them out of metal, the very top cap, you can actually cook in the heat, in the sun, cook up there, and it induces a natural flow of convection current. So the building is kind of wrapped with this liner of air that constantly is moving. And we find it's, you know, just without trying, we can get, using the system, about a 10 to 12 degree Fahrenheit drop in temperature between the inside and outside. The other thing that we've sort of discovered with the kind of this idea of boxing is that there's a redundancy. We really can't control, with a developer building, we really can't control the orientation in parts where Vastu is not predominant. But so these buildings can actually be placed and rotated anywhere on the site, and the boxing, because it's a redundant system, works really well for it. Plus, it allows for all the plumbing, which is always exposed, usually on buildings, to be in those cavity walls and hidden from exterior. So a couple of things that we learned in doing these buildings, they're all reinforced concrete buildings, and they have brick infill. And the brick is incredibly inferior. It's actually cooked on site. If you find anywhere, you'll find this all across the country. Anywhere where you find clay, a kiln emerges and brick is produced. And if your site has clay, you use all of it to produce brick. So the brick is very porous. It's sun-dried mostly and maybe hay-fired, so it's really not very strong. So it's a real tendency to let moisture through. And the double wall system allows the exterior wall to get wet and lets it drain through the cavity, and you don't get the plaster buckling on the inside, which is one of the common problems in all third world, wherever brick or masonry is used. So the inner wall is actually protected. We also, with the 1 meter, get a pretty deep overhang, and no matter where, and you want to keep the sun out both winter and summer in most of India, you're protecting the building from direct sun. As I mentioned, vents. And the third kind of thing that we did was because these sills are very deep between the inner and outer wall, a lot of dust collects on those sills, and because the landscape is not as rich, there's really a dust problem all across, especially when you have dry land. And dust collects on those sills, and when it rains, it tends to stain the building. And you kind of commonly see that all across most third world countries, and especially in India. And a kind of constant complaint that we heard over and over again from clients, users, etc. So we started to use a glazed tile in the spandrel there, so it's almost self-cleaning. So when it does stain, it can be washed really easy, and actually it gets washed by itself. So the kind of the better material that you use under the windowsill really helps keep the building clean. And if it's patterned, then you don't really notice as much the staining too. So if you can get some contrast. So it was just a cheap way to make these buildings look a little better over the long run. And then finally, none of these buildings are air-conditioned. So the cavity wall, we have knockout panels already placed in some of the rooms, and it allows for through-the-wall air conditioners to be installed if somebody wants to do that or they finally get the money. Just to kind of give you some of the senses of some of the numbers, and I'm kind of digressing here, really to kind of pick up on Jaime's talk, that unit, which is a one-bedroom unit, is 450 square feet. Okay, and the owner who might actually purchase this building might actually rent the bedroom out to someone else and live in a single room. So you might actually have two families living in there and as many as seven or eight people. Okay, and hence the toilet and the shower are separated, plus the sink is a separate. So you can have three people using the bathroom at one time. And then the kitchen is separated here. Now, even at that level of poverty, these are apartment buildings and low middle class, they would sometimes install a door across this part here, making the kitchen a separate unit. So they might actually have a cook, because there's always someone lower than you on the scale who come and work for you. So they might actually have a cook, and when they go on vacation or they're not there, they'll lock the house at that point, and then the cook can come and use the kitchen all during the day and prepare a meal for them when they return at home at night. So it's, you know, there's a lot of kind of flexibility built into these units. The next thing is form, and one of the things that we really struggled with over and over again is the idea of, because of the codes, which are really antiquated in most parts of India, to really get it just a simple wall. You know, just try to be able to create a wall that defines an edge. And the boxing really helps us do that, but this is just a typology of one of our projects where we created this kind of matrix and all these are different programs, and the kind of oddball shapes of the sites that were little corner sites, etc. And then the different kind of programs, one bedroom at three, one bedroom at two, etc. But just kind of a whole range of building types that could actually plug together, and some of these actually join up to each other so that you could make a continuous block not have to deal with the open space requirements, which require one-third of the building height to be apart. So you really can't make any urbanism under the new codes. Then the next item, which if anyone is working, I know some people have asked me questions about working in India, is this issue of FSI. Everything is sold, it's the equivalent of FAR, everything is sold and valued on FSI square foot. So that's the floor area ratio, same thing, it's here. And you buy property, and the closer you are to the city, the more expensive it is, the further out, the less. But it's always based on FSI square footage. And what you're seeing here is the net of the actual property and the gross, if it's new development, that's including a road that wraps the site. So if it's a greenfield site and a developer is doing a project, he'd be interested in the gross to service that. And if it's just bought the property, he'd be interested in the net. And the best we can get are, you know, a townhouse kind of condition, which is very uncommon in India anyway, is 0.3. It's becoming popular. And then as you go up, you'll see the numbers change and get more and more. So these are just quick studies to really understand what the capacity of the land is based on this block, you know, doing kind of generic block that we'd like to create. And then the buildings get higher, and we're looking at parking numbers are down there. But that's every developer only wants to talk about FSI. They kind of constantly, no matter what, they'll always revert back. It's a kind of knee-jerk reaction that they'll, no matter what they'll talk about, if at the start about creating great places, in the end, it's what the FSI capacity of the land is and what you've created. So these are just some very quick studies that we did for another project. This is just the same by changing the height of the building, what we were able to get. Okay. So one of the things that we kind of find is that this is what is happening all over the world, and many architectural firms are producing this kind of architecture, which is essentially high-rise buildings with a large green space within the city. So it's this kind of a Central Park mentality. And over again, that's the kind of model that everybody wants. And as opposed to smaller parks, which are more used, but less, but from the developer point of view or the government point of view, less likely to be built. They don't really understand the smaller park because in the end they're trying to sell the product, and this is the aerial kind of image all the time. You see these sort of things happening everywhere, all over the world. And again, another project, similar idea. Okay. And a project in India, again, similar, that there's a 12-acre park surrounded by high-rise buildings and no intimate parks or smaller spaces. And there's just this sense that this is when we sell a project, we want this big urban park. And it's, and in this case, unfortunately, it's actually gated. So it's only accessible to the people who live in the high-rise buildings around. So I'm going to talk about trying to apply all these principles that I've been talking about onto an actual site. So here's a site that we were given in Hyderabad, which is a city that I'm not very familiar with or wasn't very familiar with, but a city where this principle of Vastu is extremely strong. You cannot sell a unit, absolutely sell a unit, unless it complies. So forget the function. Forget that you enter right into the master bedroom or whatever, or close to the master bedroom. It is absolutely paramount that when you stand in the middle of the unit and you look at the orientation of the rooms, that from the central space, which could be your living room or special space, all these coordinates, the master bedroom is at the southwest and the kitchen's on the southeast, etc. And it's, you know, supposedly leads to health, wealth, and prosperity, and automatically, and people who don't live in these units actually get their houses broken down and rebuilt now because it's really, and they're Vastu consultants. If you Google Vastu, you'll see there's a million Vastu consultants who'll tell you how to get rich and famous very quickly by just orientating your house the correct way. Actually, it turns out that my own house, which was not Vastu compliant, but I had nothing to do with Vastu, it turns out to be very Vastu compliant, and there might be something to it. So now I'm a believer. No. Anyway, so here's the site. And this is what the most prominent Indian architect did for this site. Okay, this guy has more work, 400 or 500 architects, mostly designers working in his office. Most prolific architect. I mean, he just released a monograph that was 700 pages of work. And every young Indian architect out of school wants to serve time in his office and get some training. But this is what he did for that same site. And it's a series of towers with this kind of monster road coming in from the north. And these are all 32-story towers on the site. It meets the FSI requirements for the site. And one of the popular things that has come to India via China is something called a special economic zone. And it's very popular. You get a lot of tax breaks if you have an SEZ zone. And essentially what the SEZ zone is, it allows you to put industry in the zone tax-free, and everything that's produced by that zone is for export. So when you buy that floppy disk that says made in China, or your CD or whatever, and it says made in China, it's made in the SEZ zone tax-free, and that's why they can compete at this very low rate. It's an incredible subsidy to get foreign exchange into the country. And China's been a master at this in every location. But what, in the end, what they are compounded spaces, okay, that have no relationship to the context. You build a wall around it, and there's one way in and one way out. Okay, in this case, it's two, but it's and most of the workers arrive by bus. Very few arrive by car, and it's an incredible employment. It's where the middle class of India is really emerging from, is working in these places. And if somebody's, there's also call centers. So if someone, American Express answers your phone and got an Indian accent, he's probably working in one of these places in an SEC zone. So we modeled this and said, okay, let's kind of take a look at this. These are low-strung buildings. We didn't really understand from the plan, but this is it. It's just 24 towers, 32 floors high, just right across there. But not a single sidewalk, no sense of a pedestrian realm, because most of the people who would live in these units today, because of cheap cars and every American company, every company in the world is trying to sell a car in India, where there's no infrastructure for those cars, they think they're going to be arriving by car into these places. So that's what's being built. Okay, so we got hired, and what was interesting about this project was the architect who did the scheme actually did it for free and continues to work for this developer for free. I mean, really for free, okay? He just bangs the stuff out, because for every, 20 of these things that he does, he gets about 10 of them. So it's like a machine. He just kind of cranks these out, and he's very inexpensive, 2.5%, and he gets a lot of work, an incredible amount of work, and they're just banging these things out like you wouldn't, So us kind of taking one project away, it doesn't faze him at all. But he continued to work on this project and update it, looking at what we were doing. I said, oh, yeah, I can do that. But in the end, sort of was missing. But the developer was happy to have him continue to work, because it was always a case of comparison. He could always compare our numbers with his numbers. And so we kind of said, okay, that's fine. In the end, we did much better on the numbers with a better plan. So what we did and how we kind of, the program basically called for an SEC zone, which is this purple area, which has to be a minimum of 125 acres. That's where you get the tax break. An expansion area that might happen later, and in this particular partnership of developers, 125 acres to be developed as a township. This is, as I said, in Hyderabad, which is now Cyberabad, because all the IT companies are moving to Hyderabad, because Bangalore, which is currently the leading city in the world for producing software, has some real infrastructure problems in terms of electricity, have not been able to get their power sources worked out. And the chief minister of this state, Andhra Pradesh, has been very aggressive. Bill Clinton hangs out in Hyderabad a lot. He's been there getting his photograph taken in front of all these high-tech buildings. And so it's really catapulted this place. They're building a new airport, which I believe SOM is doing. And there's a new ring road being built, and this site is adjacent to the ring road. So all of a sudden, gone from an open site to a very valuable piece. So a series of kind of framework. This is one of, 20 different, or 3 or 20 different plans that we did very quickly. That's the other thing. They're not used to seeing alternatives in India, because it actually kind of hurts you almost to do alternatives, because they think you're indecisive. Because the architects in India, are so busy and tell the clients what they should do, when you actually show them alternatives, they kind of go like instantly. They don't know how to react, and they kind of say, well, what would you, which one would you pick? And they almost don't look at alternatives, is because it's not that kind of culture to do that. But nonetheless, we needed to really just understand that. So in the end, we kind of arrived at this plan where the SEC zone would be there, and that would be the framework. And I can show this because there was some topography to the site, and this is the other kind of classic, you know, developer walks out of the site, says, hey, it's absolutely flat, you know, don't worry. You don't need topo, you don't need any. But there was a lot of topography, and we realized that we could actually maintain the swale through the site, which is substantially, you know, 113 over here in meters, and 90, about 100 there, so 13-meter difference. So almost 40 or 50 feet difference between these two areas, and likewise, you know, between that area and here is a slight slope. So we kind of kept this kind of green space and made a central park, which was kind of paramount, one of the requirements. You had to have this kind of big, big green space. And then a series of smaller parks and school sites, et cetera, around this. And then that's the master plan for the SEZ zone with a potential school site, a hospital, and commerce, residential, for 50,000 people. Let's take a ground. This has actually evolved quite a bit, but constantly kind of working on this. You're seeing about something that around 6 weeks ago. One of the other things that happens with this incredible pressure to build, the developer who we did this project for, when I first met him 15 years ago, was struggling with one large township. Today he has seven of these townships all being built simultaneously. So there's just a tremendous amount of work and building going on, just trying to house the people who can actually today now for the first time afford housing. And just a very quick SketchUp model showing the kind of green space cutting through. Generic buildings for these SEZ block, some gateway pieces, and the way we wanted to do this was to tie in the SEC so when it, 10 years after the tax break is over, it could actually integrate seamlessly into the township so the wall would come down and the green space would move through. But also at lunchtime, these folks could actually walk into the town and eat, so hence the kind of commercial area here. So the idea that this is kind of planned for its 10-year life and then has another life after that. But the main organizing elements is, you know, CTA's pinwheel, which takes you to the hospital there, the school there, a shopping area here. There is shopping throughout the neighborhood as part of buildings because you almost have to do that at the ground level of every building. But the mall, which is invaded India too, is not actually like the American mall, thank God, but it is nonetheless, they use the word mall, and it's just really sort of a collection of small stores together in one place. It's become very popular to do that as opposed to stringing it along the street. But with this kind of density, it has to be strung along the street also. And then another public space here with a school site to the south. So that's for the hotel, which would service the SEC zone, retail, which would also help with the SEC zone. Folks can cross through the wall and eat there, a clinic, school, and central for another open space. The school kind of terminating its vista. See it down there for the green space. The shopping area also terminating. And then the long view down to the south. One of the other critical things that we deal with constantly is that currently in Asian, or especially in India, there's absolutely no address. There's no sense of address. And if you've been to India, you cannot actually get anywhere without asking several people where you have to go. All buildings have a name, but there's no numbering system, and that's a kind of a constant problem all across India. And we were very kind of cognizant about this and trying to get every building to have an address on a street. Excepting that the developer is really not interested in that because he's only interested in the drop-off for the tenants, thinking that that's the person does not want to mingle with the everyday folks on the street. But in India today, every apartment is serviced by 11 people a day. Your doorbell rings 11 times during the day because services are still brought to you, everything. You know, you want a video, you just make a call and the DVD is delivered to your house. It's also picked up. There's so much population and service that all those people, so the door, nonetheless, like every example, your car gets washed, someone comes up to your house, gets the keys, goes downstairs, washes your car. And that's where all that informal housing, that lower income strata, services the people living in these apartments. And that's why they want to be close to these developments. It's not, they don't want to be far away. They want to be right next door to these developments. But nonetheless, but the 11 people who show up seem to be unimportant to the, in the developer's mind. Why do I need an entrance for them? But nonetheless, we were able to convince him to do a street address for every building and a drop-off, and in this case, a side entrance. You still come into the same lobby where there's a service elevator that you can take up. Okay, but a typical block, and just showing how that works. It's reversed because we drive on the left side of the road. And then street section for the hierarchy of street sections. These have now been modified, but nonetheless, a hierarchy of streets so that keeping the majority of the traffic outside the township and the inner part more a pedestrian. Gross area, as I said, the last plan done by the local architect only got less than that, substantially less than that. So. And we were able to modify the height. So all our buildings are not the same height. They actually go from tall in the middle around the green spaces to much lower along the edges. So you see the kind of drop. So it's kind of a pyramid form. And this is still an early model. We're still fooling with that. But that is, this will house 50,000 people, and we need to house 20 billion, almost 100 billion people. So this is not even scratching the surface. You need to build, 1,000 of these projects today in the way the economy is going and the way people can, need housing. Okay. Some quick renderings from the earlier part, just to get an idea. This is when we were still grappling. An idea to see how that green space might work with the actual leaving the stream open through the project and what the impact might be of these tall buildings. Seen from the green space, and then the overall master plan, including the SEC zone. The SEC zone now has turned out to require FSI of one, so they have to be three or four-story buildings. But anyway, an organization for that with bus drop-offs, bus parking for the day, bus drop-offs, etc. But it's really a huge area that is just an economic zone. Footprint, and then the kind of pedestrian network allowing these two areas so the wall that will be built through here can actually come down 10 years in, and it's a mid-block condition so that these roads can actually go through, penetrate through, and the wall that would be there would not really interfere with the urbanism in the future. Okay, and that's the end to that. So it's a real dilemma, as far as I'm concerned. It's still one that we're grappling with, but one that I think needs to be addressed. And we're trying to bring this sense of organization to these plans. And this one is highly organized in Hyderabad, purely because of the Vastu issue and the orientation. I'll close with that. Thank you very much, and we'll be happy to answer any questions. Yes, Steve.
A basic understanding of new urbanism is that people like to go out in the public spaces and be in an environment of unfiltered humanity. Is that still the case? I mean, in India, turning great streets, is that going to attract people down to the school?
Absolutely. I mean, there are public spaces in Bombay, for instance, along the ocean, like the Marine Drive, which is along the ocean, that on any given Sunday, there'd be over 1 million people on this 2 mile strip, just, you know. And there is the kind of idea of the promenade. So every front, Kevin, who's here from our office, had one of those kind of claustrophobic experiences at the beach on a Sunday where he absolutely flipped out. Where's Kevin? Where he flipped out because there was just so many people. You should ask him about this on the beach, and he couldn't imagine them. And I was thinking, oh, yeah, we have all these people, but there were literally about 1 million people on this beach, and every square inch of the beach was covered with people. So, yes, there is this real tendency to go out and use the outdoor spaces. There was, if you think of India today, it is like America in 1950. Okay, just think exactly 1950, the wealth coming back from the war, and people wanting, the wealthy people wanting single-family homes, okay, wanting the kind of suburban lifestyle, other people wanting housing, okay, and a real class separation. So though all these public spaces are there, it's the kind of lower-income folks who go out, use those spaces, and therefore there's a lot of privatization of public spaces within these kind of enclaves. And we're constantly struggling with this idea of what is public and what is, you know, absolutely private. But there is a tendency on any given day, because the weather is really good, for people to be outside. And just like in the lower income areas, a lot of the cooking is always done outside. So that is, even in some of the lowest income projects, you'll find terraces where people will actually cook. They're you know, two or three story apartments, but the cooking is still done on the balcony or a terrace area.
Is that a better choice or
is that No, it's a matter of choice. It's also, you know, Indian food tends to be very aromatic. So you want to, you know, keep, it's very hard to ventilate. But you know, usually find it cooked outside. So, yes.
What are the economic drivers for growth? Are the capital sources open to the kind of urban solutions you're providing?
Yes. 15 years ago, when I did my first project in India, most of the units were bought by companies like Mitsubishi and DuPont, and 90% of the units were bought by those kind of companies and then sold back to their employees at 4% interest, so that they, you know, because there's no mobility like you see in the U.S. There's absolutely zero mobility. So when you hire somebody from Delhi and you say, you know, please come to Bombay, the first question is, you know, where will I live? Or how, you know, so there's very strong roots in the place you've grown up in, and very few people want to move from place to place. That's changing, but generally that's, you know, you have your roots in a particular place and a very strong family ties. So you only get the kind of renegades like myself who, you know, who leave and go outside. But so DuPont and all these multinationals who were setting up in India realized they could not house, the housing was an issue, they couldn't recruit, so decided to buy these units. And so the first township that I did basically became sort of an ad hoc company town for about 10 companies. And you would see the bus come in to the public space, the central space, pick everyone up in the morning and take them to the various factories or offices. So, but today, individuals are earning so much more than they ever did. So they actually, and there was no mortgage system 10 years ago. There still isn't a real mortgage system. It's a cash down system. So, but that's changing. So you do get companies now sponsoring, and mostly individual corporations sponsoring a mortgage system to buy units. So that money is, you know, is available. Yes.
This is an open-ended question. I'm just asking your observations. But I read an article recently about a new car in India that was self-driven.
Yeah.
$100. As an environmentalist horrified, as someone who believes in social equity, I can't tell them not to do it when we do it here in America. I'm just curious what your take is on.
Well, I was there for the launch of the car. I thought it was a horrible idea. I actually said that a couple times. I was coded to, you know, I said if Tata had made a $25 bicycle, that would have been an achievement. But the bicycle is $60 in India, so it's still relatively inexpensive and has a life of about 100 years. Indian bicycles have been on the road since the invention of the bicycle. They're still on the road. The same bike has been made for over 100 years. The same bike, you can get the same parts, everything for the same. But anyway, I think it's a terrible idea, but over and over again, when we talk about sustainability and automobiles, a lot of Indians are incredibly indignant about the fact that how dare you come and tell us that we can't be driving a car. And, you know, you all have been doing it for so long, and you know, here you come by and say, you know, you shouldn't have a car. And these projects are being built, and they're trying to deal with the automobile just like, and parking. They have no experience. The project that I showed has to have underground parking, and that's, again, a condition that's really never been dealt with in India, ever. But now they realize that the people who are going to buy these units want one or two cars. So it really is a dilemma to, you know, where the country is going. We have, in Bombay City, you know, there's 20 million, 16 million, depending on who you believe, there are 20 million bus tickets, 21 million bus tickets sold every day. Okay? There used to be, for the 20 million people, there used to be 10 years ago, there were 100,000 cars on the road. And today there's like, you know, 600,000 cars on the road in the same infrastructure. So, they're building kind of, you know, overpasses and all sorts of absurd things to deal with the automobile and really ruining the city in the long run. But you cannot convince most people today that this is a path that's already been traveled and failed. They want to say it's our turn, it's our time to be able to enjoy an automatic, you know, automatic cars. Automatic cars only started about 5 years ago. Everyone says, oh, we want the automatic, you know, you don't shift gears, you know. But what, you know, so it's just that kind of fascination with the West. And I think, you know, it really is an issue of not appearing backwards. Okay, it's not, I think this whole fascination is that they don't want to be perceived as we're backwards. And it's that kind of fear, and I think that's the same fear in China today. We want the latest, most modern, most outrageous looking so that we appear forward, you know, in cutting edge. So, yes.
China has shown how the president in Latin America was very typical, is sort of discombobulated, doesn't have any radical changes that work themselves out effectively. What I haven't seen on any of the slides is the positive of that. I have part of the pieces that I have made in part of, which we did see before we did announce. And I don't know if that's been done, if you consider that. I know it's scale 20 million, but still when a project like this belongs to the T6 adjacent to T1,
right.
Not necessarily the scale of the Manhattan to Grand Central Park, Central Park. What about the T4, T5? The T3 is where actually a lot of the traditional urban lifestyle resolves itself within a block. Very more informal way as opposed to holding them apart. Just probably a question about
the program. Honey, what's your opinion?
In shanty towns, you don't have, I mean, the fried egg theory that you see in the typical transect that Andres shows. I mean, from T1 to T6, smoothly going, I mean, in one direction. And I think that, I mean, as I showed in my presentation, 75% of the world is not based on the fried egg theory. I mean, the transect really happens, in patches all over the place. And you have to be really careful when you're doing a dissection of the city, because it's not going to be in a straight line. I mean, it's going to be one piece here, one piece there, one piece there, one piece there. And the same thing happens in shanty towns. I mean, most of the shanty towns are T4, T5, and T6. And you don't find T3, T2s, and T1s in shanty towns. Now, regarding the abrupt contrast of the project that, the project that you're forced to do when you're faced with this thing, I simply don't know what to do. I don't know.
Yes?
Just coming at that from another question, it seems to me that the shanty towns have a set of qualities in terms of the organic way they're made, the fine grain mixed uses, the really well defined set of plots and those typologies. Is there a middle ground between the formal approach that you took and the organic or random approach? Can we evolve from the qualities of the shanty town and give people a positive choice that isn't far away?
Yeah, I think there is right now. I mean, we just have to kind of get over this first big hurdle, the boom, and then try to step back and kind of look at other models. I think everything, and sort of to answer both questions, if an area gets developed, it instantly goes to T6 because of the economic pressure. And we did this one project and we had 15,000 people living there, and they had the kind of grand opening and all DuPont and all these people took possession of their apartments, and next day there were 15,000 people. We hadn't really kind of caught up on the kind of commercial, the shops hadn't been sort of fitted out, etc. And there was an incredible pressure instantly to get, restaurants and grocery stores. And the developer just set up these kind of cinder block, tin-roofed structures all along the road, just very quickly. And because there was that much pressure to service, to get service the people who were living there. And so you got this kind of shanty town built instantly. That had to be, relocated later. But that was the kind of, you got all these people. And for those 15,000 people who were living there, imagine when I said 11, your doorbell rings 11 times, there's 70,000 people who are going to be able to service those people, okay, who are going to come there and, try to kind of, make a living. So, it's very difficult to kind of control the development pressure. I think the more organic developments are happening in places where you're looking at infill opportunities. And in a couple projects where one project that we were involved in, there was a mill in the middle of the city, and the city had now grown around it, and the mill closed, and we were looking to develop it. And there, because of the existing patterns of the city, it was a much more organic, and also we were able to get lower scale into it. All the parts of Bombay might have a T4, but the T4 is a 5 or 6 story block apartment building. Generally, the only people who live in homes, in a single family home, I'm making this a gross generalization, but generally are professors in a university in one of the kind of classic traditional universities in India, because housing is provided to professors and it's usually a single family home. So if you go to even to IIM, the Lucan project in Ahmedabad, all the faculty live in townhomes in that project. You go to any IIT, Indian Institute of Technology, any of their campuses, all the faculty live in single-family houses. But that's generally the only place where, someone can say, I got a single-family home. But even the wealthiest people live in apartments. And most of the single-family lots have been redeveloped with apartment buildings. So all of Malabar Hill, which was like the Bollywood, Hollywood of Bombay, used to be single-family villas done by American architects for the film stars. It looked a lot like Hollywood in the 60s, with these really wonderful homes scattered in the hills, are all been replaced by apartment buildings. I mean, 90% of them are gone, so.
And if I may add something else, what attracted most of us to a new urbanism in the first place was the fact that we had a crusade to reconstruct, to restore, to reconstitute urban spaces. I mean, that was what attracted us in the first place. These people that live in shanty towns have a clear distinction in their minds between quantity and quality. They don't want quantity of public space. They want quality of public space. And because they're looking for quality of public space, they're designing that space daily. I mean, it's not a space that is drawn in the drawing table of an architect 3 miles or 3,000 miles away from where the site is. It's a series of decisions that are taken there in place. I mean, and that are taken every single day. Let's move the frontage a little bit to here, because it's better, because it's going to allow me to see the sign from here. I mean, it's like the same procedure that medieval towns had. I mean, that the more you encroach on the public right away, the more power you demonstrate. That the less amount of land that you have, the less, the lower caste you belong to. Et cetera, et cetera. So it's decisions that are taken incrementally. I mean, we talk so much about incremental development here, but we really don't let incremental development happen. And the lesson that I think is important about what I just showed, I mean, I'm like a virus. And I always say these things in every Congress for the New Urbanism, and people pay attention to what I say like 40 years later. But whatever, I mean, this is the virus that I want to leave today. That we're not paying attention really to incremental development, and that somehow we need people to allow us to, with their own intelligence, to tell us exactly how it is that incremental development should happen. I mean, I've been hearing the word evolution constantly, I mean, in this Congress today. I mean, the evolution of urbanism, the evolution of the house, the evolution of this and that. I mean, these developments are really evolving developments. I mean, they start with a little tent. They end up with a skyscraper.
Yes.
Well, I'm assuming that there are developments in India. Developments.
Yes.
Okay. I think that's what the problem is. If I were to compare the shanty town development in India in terms of experiential and visual richness, I would say the shanty town is so much from so little. And for Indians, so little from so much. The key thing here is that shanty towns grow out of the culture. And they're not intended to be beautiful. They are like the bird singing or the spider wing really expect. You know? They come out of the nature of the culture. And that's why they're what they are. And they get adjusted every day based on, you know, predictions that they do. I think one of the key items in our discussions on the is development the only way to develop this? I know there are one or two examples. I think one, Michael Firetop, whom you may know, Seattle, has formed some groups of lawyers, some community development corporations, and the future owners of the buildings, and they all act as developers themselves. The difference is that when you build as a culture, you actually carry the cultural agenda into what you build. When you build as a developer, you carry the developer's agenda.
Right. Well, thank you. I mean, I fully agree. It's again, the issue of numbers, you know, and how do you deal with, because, and I don't think the government has done too well in any situation with the house, trying to solve the housing problem. I think one of the fundamental differences with the housing projects in India, at least, that have been done by the government has been that they're monocultures.
They tend to be strictly housing projects, and the people who live in those projects are forever stigmatized because they live in that project. And every project, and so we've gone down that road, and there are many, many projects where, and today that's really changing because the people who have lived in these projects now actually have the ability to get out of those projects, and there is no mechanics for them to really, you know, leave gracefully or, you know, so that is an issue. On the other hand, you've got the developer trying to fit that middle-income group who all of a sudden has access to a company subsidized mortgage. So, you know, where do you fall? But, you know, there's so many people in India currently who have the job, has a decent job, and has no place to live. So, you know, you could, my driver, who has been my driver for a long time, lives in a shanty town, you know, and he gets up every morning and he finds some place to take a shower and some place to, you know, and comes to work dressed up, but has absolutely no, and in his income group, though he's making, you know, a fair income to support a family, has no form of, you know. You know, I mean, I think, you know, the problem is, you know, for instance, the World Bank has a program called Sites and Services, which is a program where they give each family 40 square meters, a 15-amp electrical plug, and sewer and water. Okay, and you build your own home, or you start with a tent and, you know, build your own home, and it's got a kind of free-form structure in most cases. But, you know, once the government intervenes and tries to be rational about it, a rational plan emerges, and you lose that life. You know, so the sites and services projects individually are very creative, but the organic form is missing because it hasn't allowed for that to, you know. So when you go to those projects, you find that, and the bigger issue is that they're too distant from the workplace. And we really need that to be able to accommodate the shantytown close to the high-rise building, because that's who they serve, and that's where the money comes from.
Well, that's what happens every time they do those.
Right.
They move the people out there, and the people
uh-huh.
back to the
shantytown. Right, uh-huh. Exactly. I mean, every New Bombay, which is a new project on the mainland across the river from Bombay, nobody who was allocated a house there actually lives there, because they all sold their units to someone who could afford it and then moved back onto the street. So, well, thank you very much. We're happy to answer more questions. Hey.
Sorry,
it's okay.